Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, we discover how plants can help us unearth human remains. The World Wildlife Fund claims that wildlife is in catastrophic decline due to human destruction. But what can we do about it? And over 100 years since Robert Lloyd Praeger published his Clare Island Survey, Richard Collins casts his eye on the latest survey to come from this exposed Atlantic island.
Doing a survey 100 years ago, you wouldn't have the fancy binoculars and telescopes. And they would have binoculars, but they wouldn't be great. And you wouldn't have the reference books or the experience. Even getting to the place, it's, 5 kilometres out or something. You probably had to go on a Corrig or something. It is a much more challenging thing to do and a much more problematical thing to do than it is for us to do it now. Are the results comparable as a result?
I think so. If you look at the bird paper by Usher, they covered virtually the whole year over the 1909-1911 interval. So they did go out in most months and they spent quite a bit of time there, particularly Professor Patton and Praeger himself and various others. So I think that the results are comparable insofar as any survey of an island 110 years later is comparable. I think it is comparable, yeah.
Yeah, very busy programme, I remember. I spent some time on Clare Island filming for Secrets of the Irish Landscape, and the scientific advisor behind that programme is with us in studio today, Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin. Matthew, very welcome to the programme today.
Thank you, Derek.
And Aina Nilana is here also. Aina, how are you?
Oh, the old chest, and I'm here as well.
Yeah. Indeed. And at home, still, I don't want to say the word cocooning because Aina will jump off me, but in lockdown or kind of minding himself. Well, give me a better term, Aina.
No, I have nothing against cocoon, and I'm saying lockdown is the wrong word because we're not locked down. We're advised.
We're advised.
Ordered.
Well, Richard's still at it in Malahide. Richard, how are you today?
Hello, Derek. I'm like one of the old monks in the huts in Skellig Michael or something. I'm very isolated, but surrounded by a rather nice environment. No. There are benefits.
I'm sure there are. And you're there with your lovely wife too, Barbara. Now, Matthew, we're going to be talking a little bit about Clare Island later on. You know a lot about this island. Beautiful place.
Extraordinary. Because, I mean, we know so much about it from a century ago. It is fascinating for any biologist to visit now to see what has happened, what has been the impact of humanity and farming subsidies and so on to the nature of that island.
Well, Richard is going to be talking to Thomas Kelly specifically about the birds. Has bird life changed? Has it increased? Has it decreased? Are the same birds there? Are there new birds there? Etc, etc. So I'm looking forward to that a little bit later on. Aina, Matthew's spoken there about the impact we can have on populations and the biodiversity of islands. What about what's happening around the world? According to the WWF, wildlife is in catastrophic decline.
Human activity is destroying nature at a rate that has never been seen before. In a new major report, the World Wide Fund for Nature organisation says wildlife populations have fallen by more than two-thirds in 50 years.
This is true. They've done a survey in 2018, 2017, 2018, 2019, and the 2021 has come out. And going back to 1970, 68% of the populations of animals, vertebrates with backbones in the world, is gone. Not species, but the actual numbers of these. This is what the latest survey has shown. So the interesting thing the survey has shown this time is that the rate of decline is different in the different continents. Like in Latin America and the Middle Americas, the number of actual animals has gone down by over 90%. Whereas in Europe, the number of animals has gone down by a mere 26%, which of course begs the question, why is this the case? And I suppose we were just saying about this, myself and Matthew, before the programme began, that when they started to count in Europe, human influences had already reduced the original number. So we had already influenced wildlife in Europe detrimentally, Whereas in places like Middle America and Latin America and South America, the numbers were pristine in maybe in 1970s and are not so now because land use change has happened enormously. It's really awful to see this happening. Down 68% overall on average, the numbers of wild animals that are there. And this, the report maintains, is mainly due to land use change. Now, climate change is having an impact, but the main thrust is the different uses of land that's being made, reducing the biodiversity, getting rid of different habitat destruction for food crops, for people to live, mining, doing all of this sort of thing that destroys the habitat. And we're reaping the whirlwind because this COVID disease that we have now is because we are living too close to wild animals, but there's no barriers, there's no habitats for them. We're cheek by jowl with them. And I mean, this is the case with other zoonoses as well, flus and things that we've had over the century. Biodiversity, which is what's been lost here, this is what's being measured, is not just something that brown bread and sandal types, people like us who have a specialised programme on this. This is something that affects the whole world, whether we like it or not. It's not just to do goodies over there. It's actually affecting how we all live. And I mean, just how many millions of people have this COVID now caused because biodiversity has been reduced.
So what do we do? What can we do?
Well, stop doing it.
Stop doing what? Come on, tell me. The question today is, what can we do about it?
Well,
you, Matthew, Richard, everybody else.
We're putting too much pressure on the world. And as a consequence, we've got to stop doing that. So the talk of using eating food that doesn't cost the earth to actually produce, becoming more of a plant eater rather than eating meat that costs a huge amount of space to produce, buying things that are expensive and keeping them for ages rather than buying fast things they could throw away at once, by not using things like plastics that go end up, there's more plastic in the sea, as we all know now. The weight of plastic is greater than the weight of fish. You know, how many plastics did you handle today and why did you handle them and why are you doing this? If there's no, I mean, plastics weren't around when I was young, and I'm not as old as Richard Collins, actually, I'm acting like that. And I mean, even when I was young, there was no plastics. I mean, it was invented, okay, there was Bakelite and stuff, but all the things that we actually did in the 1950s did not require the vast amount of plastics that are needed now. And I'm still alive, which is great. So, like, we need to actually cop on that we can't be using the world's resources willy-nilly. And of course, I mean, the other thing, the elephant in the room, if you like, is the huge population. We nearly have, 7-8 billion people in the world. In 1900, we had 1.5 billion. So that's in the 120 years, we've gone from 1.5 billion to nearly 8 billion. And that,
so are you recommending contraception?
No.
Or are you saying let's get rid of a few billion? What are you saying?
Well,
the facts are they are. I mean, people are here. We can't just wipe them out, will you?
No, I'm not saying.
I can live, but you can't.
Yeah, you know what I mean. You know, we can't. That's not what I'm trying to say. But the reason why this has happened, of course, is because we've people live longer and babies don't die when the mortality.
But that's good, surely.
And that is excellent indeed. But as populations become more educated, the numbers of babies that are born are fewer. So in Europe, in many of the European countries, the reproduction rate is less than reproduction, that there are fewer people being born than are dying. So the populations there are declining. So it's a function of poverty. It's a function of having no social welfare. You have lots of children. It's a function of not having the availability. I mean, I'm not sure that every woman that has 16 children wants to have them.
No, for sure.
If they have no option, if there's no education, if there's nothing to do this. I mean, this really is the bottom line in a sense. The fact that limiting your family is considered to be a religious matter and other people's business is absolutely appalling. And that's still the case.
Richard, Ain is not as old as you, apparently.
I am, well, she's getting there. She's catching up.
Thank you, Richard, for those kind words.
And with age comes wisdom, Anna.
Okay, well, share your wisdom with us. Come on.
Well,
share your wisdom.
Anna mentioned that the rate of decline is different in different parts of the world. It's also different in different habitats. Now, what is really ominous about this is that in some places, the point of no return may have been passed. A paper appeared last month in August by a scientist at Ohio State University. Now, Michaela King is her name. Now, she studies the melting of the Greenland ice sheet. Now, ice sheets are rather like bank accounts. You have to put money in to meet the expenditure. And if you don't put enough in, you will go bankrupt. Now, in the case of the ice sheet, it's the snow falling on the sheet that's the input of water. And the expenditure is the melting of water from the glaciers around its rim. Now, she has measured this over 30 years. There's 30 years of records, and she's looked at it. And she says that the melt is greater than the input. But the really ominous bit is that even if we stop and do everything right and we abolish global warming or our contribution to global warming, it will still continue. The ice, that has dreadful implications for the polar ice mass. It has dreadful implications for sea level rise. It rose by something like 20 centimetres in the 20th century. It could, according to some predictions, reach 2.7 metres beyond what it is today by the end of this one. Nobody
so we're all going to drown in a biblical flood sort of thing.
Well, those living where I am, too close to the water's edge, but I'll be dead and gone. As Helena pointed out, I'm far too old to last that long. But think of the poor walrus, the polar bear, the seals of the Arctic. Their habitat is doomed, if she's correct.
Matthew.
Right. Well, of course, you know, it is, as any biologist knows, appalling to look around the world and see what has happened, what humanity has done to it. However, we need to preach, rather than a gospel of despair, how can we fix it? And there are numerous scientists who have pointed out that the cost of combating climate change would be not much more than 1% of the global economy. It is tiny. And what we need to do is make sure that enough human beings in democratic countries appreciate what we can do to fix these problems. Having done that, we can then bring about the political pressure to bear to actually correct them. So it requires a cost. And it's in global terms, in economic terms, protecting wildlife, protecting the globe from the imminent crisis of climatic change can be done. But it is like unilateral disarmament. Everybody has to progress it. And we need to have countries being brave enough to make this statement so that more countries around the world will join
it. But make what statement? You're suggesting we all work together, excuse me, like we've worked together globally to tackle the coronavirus outbreak. Okay, so everybody has put in place in their respective countries a set of guidelines for people to follow. And some people follow them and some people don't. Everybody should do their best to follow them where possible. And that this will reduce the spread of this virus and then hopefully knock it on the head and we'll develop a vaccine and we'll get over this and we'll move on. Yep. And we'll be more careful in the future, hopefully. Now, you're saying we can do a similar thing with this catastrophic decline in wildlife. Ayn is saying, on one hand, that we're intruding into territory we shouldn't be in. We're living too close to wild animals. There's too many people in the world because they all have to be fed. And we're eating animals when we should perhaps be looking at plants. So she is saying one thing. What are you saying? You're saying it needs money, but to do
no,
what?
No,
what? To do what Ayn is saying, or to do what?
I'm saying what is needed is we have to convince enough people on this planet that we have to tackle it right now. And at the moment, we have used fear and horror and an appalling future to try and frighten people into it. And actually, it's not worked. We need to explain to people in ways that they will comprehend about how important it is to immediately put
a freeze. Are you telling me there's a single person in the developed world that is not aware of climate change?
Yes, but they all...
And still it's happening. As Richard has said, we could be past that point already. It may be too late to go back from there. But is it not drastic measures in order to push through new laws, to close down cities, to do certain things, to stop aviation, literally in its tracks? There's no planes flying, or very, very few, let's be honest about it. And to say, this is an emergency. We're fed up trying to explain it to you. This is what has to happen. Because explaining doesn't work.
No government will be voted in on that agenda.
The present governments in place in this country was not voted in on the present agenda at the moment.
No, I know
it wasn't. Can't travel here, you can't travel there, you can only visit six people. So it doesn't matter. The governments are in place and they just take these draconian measures in order to stop the decline. That's what I'm saying. Yes. Well, it's out there.
It wouldn't
dictator.
It wouldn't succeed to try and say, right, we're going to spend 2-3% of our economy now on measures to combat climate change. The horror that would run through our society
would
prevent it.
We're borrowing money at the moment. We're borrowing billions more than we ever conceived we would borrow, you know? So, I mean, yes, things are possible. If there's a will to do it, if the world's governments get together, as you said, democratic governments get together and sit down and say, for the benefit of everybody, we must do this.
And people have been saying this repeatedly and it hasn't worked.
Okay, so they let's imagine they get the money.
Yeah.
To what with it?
We need to spend it in combating the carbon greedy economy that we drive. We need to straight away say we can't have growth. Growth cannot exist economically forever. It has to stop. The planet is finite. So we'd have to freeze economic growth. And if you were putting that out as your strategy, that we're going to go for 0% economic growth in Ireland, you won't get many votes.
No, but as I'm saying to you, they've managed to do things now when they're in office, ain't it?
No, but I mean, the awful thing is that people see taking measures against climate change, people in developed countries, that is, they see this as reducing their standard of living and reducing their wealth. And this is why they won't push for it, they won't do it, because it's going to make their lives less comfortable than it was. People who want to eat meat don't not want to eat meat. People that want to drive cars don't not want to drive cars. Even things like carbon taxes. I mean, the solution is very simple. Although it's very difficult, it's stop putting carbon up and suck the carbon that's there back out again, because it's the carbon in the atmosphere that's warming it up. And the only way we can put
it up... That's how you tackle climate change.
Yeah, the only way you put it up is by burning fossil fuels, and the only way you get it down is by photosynthesis. So that means more trees, because they're the biggest plants to take it out, and stop burning it. Full stop, amen, end of burning of fossil fuels. Warm yourself up any way you like, drive your cars any way you like, fly your airplanes any way you like, but from this moment on, nothing more is to be burnt all over the world. Because if they decided burning fossil fuels was going to give you blue marks on your face or some terrible disease, we'd all stop it in the morning, because we personally would be worse off if we kept burning. But the fact that we're not worse off, in fact, we're better off in our own personal little bubble if we're burning fossil fuels.
So it's not affecting us as individuals, and that's why nothing has been really...
COVID is affecting us as individuals.
A lot has been done, but not a lot.
The great phrase to use here is something called tragedy of the commons, where we have something in common, we overexploit it. If it's in our own back garden, we can see physically, we'd say, ooh, you know, we've used up half of that, or we've used up three quarters of it, we will use less of it now. But we don't see it because we hold it in common around the globe.
But we must take action. Richard.
Yes, I've been following the debate in the United States to the extent to which I can between the two protagonists. Now,
well, they haven't mentioned it very much from what I can see.
That is the awful thing. As far as I can tell, I mean, maybe I'm totally wrong in this, but I get the impression they haven't even mentioned the environment. And I would have thought Biden would hammer Trump for his behaviour on this. He's a total disaster. I think what's despairing is that the most prosperous countries like Europe, like America, like Australia, the very ones that have it in their power to do something, are the worst offenders, it would seem to me.
This report that we're talking about, the World Wildlife Report, I was looking at it, and there's actually a map of the ecological footprint of the different countries, and there's purple and there's blue and there's different colours. And as Richard mentioned, Canada and the United States are purple. Australia is purple. Scandinavia is purple. And Ireland is purple. Even Britain, even Great Britain, is only blue. It's not purple. We're actually purple.
And purple is bad.
Purple is the worst. It's the worst.
Greater
than 5 hectares per person is needed to keep the standard of living in. Well, you'd expect it in America. You'd expect it in Australia. But it's Ireland and not Britain. I mean, if you look at the map with Ireland and Britain, Northern Ireland is the blue and we're the purple. We're even worse. So we're certainly not saying, well, we're grand in Ireland. Other bold people are doing it. We are as bad. We need 5 hectares per person to keep the lifestyle that we're generating. And We can't afford to point the finger at anybody else.
It's
We're not even doing it ourselves in our own country.
It's all very negative.
But it is all very
negative.
It is,
and we have to actually have something positive. We have to say simple things like actually restoring ecological restoration of habitats is extremely simple and it is extremely beneficial. And the more we can concentrate on that right now, the more we can protect the little that is left. Because it's been well proven that, you know, once you re-wet a bog, once you allow a bit of native woodland to sit there without being damaged, it restores itself. There are many, many stories from around the world where fantastic restoration jobs have been done to habitats. So that is the gospel of positivity that we need to be spreading and convince people. There is a way to protect the little that is left.
Okay, well, we'll move on from that now because I want to talk to you about parasitic plants. Oh, Matthew, that's yes. why you're here today, because I read an article during the week about the dodder plant, and I thought, is yes. this growing along the River Dodder? Is it's only around the corner. I better read more about this. And it was talking about the dodder plant and photosynthesis and how it takes its cues from its host species. And I thought, oh, this sounds very interesting. And I read even more and I thought, oh, no, I'm lost. I don't understand it. Get Matthew Jebb in. Can you explain?
First of all,
tell us about the dodder plant. What is it? Does it actually grow in the River Dodder in Dublin or what? And what is it all about?
It's a bizarre looking plant. It's a flowering plant and it has little flowers on it. But for the rest of the its life, it has no leaves, it does no photosynthesis, it looks like red or yellow threads. It looks like somebody has dropped a ball of wool or something onto plants, but even finer, they're like little cotton threads. And these little threads, they grow around, and as soon as they touch the green stem of another plant, they coil around it and they shove little things we call haustoria. They're like little fingers that penetrate the grass plant or the daisy plant, and they suck the food out of that plant, and that's where it gets its nutrition. So it's a plant that is parasitizing other plants to get all of its food source. And what these Chinese botanists have discovered is that the dodder plants in China are also using the hormones of the plants they're parasitizing to work out when they are flowering, and they flower at the same time. Now, what's important about that is if you as a parasite start feeding on another plant, who's to say that other plant hasn't just about reached the end of its life and in 2 weeks' time it's going to die? And the poor old dodder plant doesn't realize this. It might run out of food before it's produced its flowers and seeds and babies for next year. So by using the hormones of the plant it's parasitizing, it is flowering at the same time. And any plant that flowers will continue living long enough to produce fruits and seeds. So this is what is so clever about this dodder plant, that it is making sure that it has got a food source right through for the production of its own fruits.
And how unusual is it?
It's not that unusual in some of them. And the name of it in Ireland is broom rape, actually. And they're called the broom rapes. I mean, dodder is a more universal word, but it's and it grows on, it does ivy broom rape, which grows on ivy. I was looking at that in Enniskerry there recently. They have it growing on thyme. They have it growing on broom. And then there's another one then called toothwort, which is in the same general family. And it grows on trees, on holly or sycamore. It grows on their roots. And it has a great name. It's called the corpse flower because it actually has a white flower, like nearly like an orchid. And this suddenly appeared with no leaves, no nothing. So how could it be so white and pale and ghostly? Only it must be growing on corpses. So these plants were known in Ireland, and they're abundant where their host is. The ivy broom rape is abundant enough. The one you're speaking of with the red strings all over it is the thyme broom rape, and that's an Aran Island job. I've only seen this on sand dunes. You know, they are around. A yellow rattle that you get in meadows is another one, not a rape now like those ones, but it's one that parasitizes grasses. And farmers with grass fields long ago didn't like the yellow rattle because it made their grasses be much more weak, whereas we love it now because of part of a wildflower mix. It keeps manners on the dastardly grass and lets the other wildflowers grow.
We always distinguish between two types of plant parasites. Some, like mistletoe, which have got green leaves themselves, but they are sitting on top of trees. So it means that they have achieved in a year or two a height of 50 or 60 foot above the ground. So mistletoe is growing on the branches of trees, and it is just sucking its water and minerals out of the stems of that tree. Mm-hmm. But it's growing its own photosynthetic materials with its own green leaves. So there's a difference between plants that get all of their sustenance from their hosts, like the toothwort, which it's got a sort of pink stem and white flowers, like Aina said, which does look like teeth in a gum. So it's got a very spooky appearance.
And of course, the one that's not a parasite and does all its own work is ivy. And people are always saying, oh, ivy is a parasite. It's killing trees and sucking things out of it. It's a bit lazy and it hasn't got a backbone and it climbs up the tree to hold it up. But it does its own thing. It makes all its own food, doesn't it, Matthew?
Exactly. So an ivy is simply a climber, like you say, and it often very deleterious. It will harm and sometimes kill a tree just by its sheer
weight
growth.
And damage. And it grows on walls, which aren't trees at all, and it can take the water out of the mortar and the bricks and that. So in some cases, people don't want it in their particular habitat. But it is not dissimilar to the strangler fig, any of these ghastly looking things that you hear about. Or indeed, Rafflesia. Rafflesia is a great joke altogether. This is the big flower that you get in the Amazon rainforest, or the Amazon, but there's tropical rainforest, and it's got a flower like a cabbage. Great big thing like a cabbage. And it stinks to high heaven. They call that one really is a corpse flower, because the creatures that come along think that there's rotten flesh inside in it. And this is what they're looking for. And they penetrate this to get the food and, of course, go off then with pollen on themselves. But it smells like dead meat. It must be awful. You haven't got it.
And is this the biggest flower in the world? You're going to.
Exactly.
How is it called again?
Rafflesia.
Rafflesia.
Called after Mr. Raffles.
It's actually a relative of vines growing in the forests of Borneo. And the bud of this flower is the size of a football. It's got five gigantic petals, and it is the biggest flower of any flowering plant in the world. And yet it has no leaves or stems or roots. It is simply a flower that bursts out of the stems of these plants. And for many years, we didn't know where to put it in the classification system, because it's lost so many genes that the normal genes that we use through DNA research, we can see who is most closely related to who in the plant world. And it is only very recently we've discovered that Rafflesia is actually a member of the spurge family.
Spurge, the one with the white milk inside.
Exactly, it was very unexpected. But once you look at it and you compare it to all these tropical spurges, the family Euphorbiaceae, a lot of botanists go, of course, now I can see it. Now that you tell me what it is actually related to, I can understand.
Had you one in the botanic gardens, weren't you?
No. We've grown the host plant, but we've never been able to get seed. It's a very rare flower. When it bursts out, it has very little chance of setting seed, because whilst an extraordinary parasite, you have to have two different flowers, because one is male and one is female. So unless a male and a female are in close proximity and the flies go from the male to the female plant, no seeds will arise.
Is there any benefit to a parasitic plant? Well, what's their purpose in life?
One of the amazing things about biological life is the longer you leave it, the more diverse it gets. So you go to the rainforest and there are more species of plant and insect there than sort of any other habitat on Earth. And it's to do with the stability and the long time that it has sat there unaffected by major shifts in climate. So biological life has this inner push to become more and more species rich. And it is one of the great sort of phenomena of natural selection, as discovered by Charles Darwin, to account for evolution, that biological life on this planet will constantly try to strive to become richer and richer in species. And it's an amazing thing, the different lifestyles that each species adopt allows natural selection to select for more and more species.
That's very interesting. Anna mentioned the strangler fig. Now, it raises an interesting issue here. There are very few purely parasitic creatures. Most parasites give something back. They pay the rent in some way. Now, the strangler fig, I understood always, choked the poor old tree that it grew up on. These things are extraordinary. They're like cages around the tree, and they suck it away, and all his good is gone, and he dies, kind of thing. But in fact, I read somewhere later that the strangler figs provide extra strength for the tree in a gale. Now, is it true of other parasitic plants? For instance, the yellow rattle is a parasitic plant. And somebody told me that it helps to cut down the grass, the profusion of grass, if you have yellow rattle growing, because the yellow rattle takes away some of the nutrients from the grass, exploits the grass, and it helps to reduce the amount of grass. But that seems odd, because if you eliminate your host, you're on a hiding to nothing. You know, the cuckoo eliminates the young of the midopipit, and if it does that too successfully, there won't be any warblers or midopipit for it to parasitize. So is there a contract within this parasitic world?
There's a beautiful contract there with the cuckoos, for example. If the cuckoos start to increase in numbers, yes, they obliterate their host, and therefore they have a population dive themselves. So the balance of nature works to ensure that cuckoos have to be rare. Parasites have to be rare, because if they become common, like you say, they would inhibit their source of food. So whether it's a predator and prey, you know, if a predator starts eating too much of its prey, it runs out of food and the predator dies out. And when it dies out, the prey increase in number. So there's a beautiful sort of balance constantly going on, the battle of nature, hence the, you know, nature being red in tooth and claw as an idea of representing this phenomenon.
There is another cuckoo, the lesser spotted cuckoo in southern Europe, lays its eggs in other birds. So bigger birds, ravens and crows and things of this kind, but it does not melt them dry. In fact, it helps them. And the success of raven and crow nests that are parasitized goes up, not down. So parasites can work in mysterious ways. Do they do that in the plant kingdom?
Well, in the case of orchids, you have a situation whereby the seeds of the orchids are absolutely tiny. And orchid seeds, if you try to grow them, they haven't enough food stored in the orchid seeds to actually give it the oomph to go from germinating the seed to get up above the soil, open its first leaves and start making food. So the only way you can grow the orchids with these tiny seeds is that they have to actually become involved with a fungus in the soil, steal the food from the fungus in order to get up to make its own food, and then it pays the rent, if you like, back to the fungus once it actually has done this. But then that's called symbiosis rather than straightforward parasitism, I think. Isn't that right, Matthew?
Exactly. There's gradations from mutualism, where you're living together in mutual benefit, symbiosis, again, literally meaning living together, all the way through to parasitism. So there's a gentle shift, and the entire family Orchidaceae, the vast majority of them, absolutely dependent upon their fungus for that germination period. So if the orchids were to disappear, probably that fungus would be fine. But if the fungus disappears, the orchids would be lost. And therefore, one has to say that in that relationship, yes, whilst it's symbiotic, there is a level of parasitism there, that the orchid is parasitic on the fungus. So it's a strange way of actually looking at the world once you understand that these relationships between different organisms are one of the great drivers of evolution. There are tricks that natural selection has come up with, which is to go in for sheer diversity. So, for example, the cuckoos in Ireland will parasitize a range of different species of bird, because if they concentrate just on one little songbird, then their pressure on it would be sometimes catastrophic to the local population.
In fact, that's what we're hoping that's going to happen with COVID, because if the thing is such a virulent thing that it kills its host out, it's gone too. So that we're hoping, one of the hopes of this is that the virus will somehow ameliorate and not become as virulent, and then it won't destroy its hosts and it won't be so hard to manage. And this has happened in the case of other bacterial and other things that have affected humans or other species.
Yes.
Because yeah. if you're too good at it and you kill the host, that's the end of you. So you don't want to kill the thing that you depend upon to live.
I mean, many of the other coronaviruses that are endemic, that is, they're already living in the human population, are represented by colds. They're simple little sniffles and colds we get in the winter. But there's a diversity of coronaviruses that probably originally got into the human population as a virulent plague at the time. And this is probably what will happen to this current COVID-19.
Guys, you're going to be fascinated by this next story, because whether it's Love, Hate, The Fall, Dublin Murders or many others, crime series are among the most watched television programmes in Ireland. A familiar problem for the killer, it would appear, is the disposal of a dead body. The subsequent search for the remains is a recurring headache for the investigating team. Woodlands present a particular problem for detectives, where surveys, aerial footage and dog teams are limited in their capacity to locate human remains. But now, the dense undergrowth, which effectively conceals the grave, may in fact provide signposts to where the deceased is hidden. Forensic experts in the United States have begun experiments looking at how decomposing bodies release compounds in the surrounding environment, which alter the look of plants, including leaf colour. Neil Stewart Jr. is a professor of plant sciences at the University of Tennessee and a senior author of a new study into how vegetation can help us find dead bodies. Oh my God, I can feel the kind of shiver going up and down my spine, Neil. Tell me more about this.
Well, it's more of an idea at this point than finding all the details yet. But we do have a crack team of experts, including soil scientists and anthropologists, and then a couple plant people, to try to understand how plants can respond to decomposing bodies.
And the point of the matter is, I suppose, that plants growing on human remains would be getting something special from the human remains and would be different to surrounding plants. This would be the ideal scenario. When you get this plant growing, there must be a human corpse underneath it. Is that really possible?
Oh, I think it is possible. You know, plants are champions at responding to the environment. When people die and they start to decompose, like we've seen here at the University of Tennessee Body Farm, especially when it's so warm like it's been this summer, they decompose very quickly and release a lot of nitrogen into the soil.
One of the amazing stories I know in the last decade or so has been this work on nitrogen and carbon isotopes in the Pacific Northwest that demonstrate that salmon running up the rivers, dying after spawning, are providing a huge mineral input, particularly nitrogen, to the surrounding forest. So, you know, that is the ability of us now as scientists, that we can measure just such microscopic traces. But I suppose what you need is a bigger, more obvious change in colour or spectral appearance of leaves.
When you say a human, when it decomposes, produces all this nitrogen, but maybe it's a dead cow, maybe it's a dead sheep or something. Why would human nitrogen be any different to sheep nitrogen or cow nitrogen?
It wouldn't, of course. Right. But the idea is here is that in the woodlands, at least in the wild, there are not that many mammals that are as large as humans.
Yes, so that would be a big pulse of nitrogen in a patch of woodland.
Just looking at the idea of natural things, if you like, coming out of bodies like phosphates, like nitrates. But humans are different to all other creatures in the sense that we eat processed food, we eat cooked food, we get injections, we get chemicals put into us. Does any of that have an impact on the vegetation around it, rather than the natural things that come out of any corpse? What about something that would only come out of a human corpse because of the way we live?
Well, that's a very good point, and it's something that we've thought about. One property that humans have that, let's say, deer or other large mammals may not have is our very long lifespan, and we tend to accumulate certain things in our bodies. But let's say that someone was taking a drug that happened to have some fluorescence. It's possible that plants could uptake that and you would end up seeing the fluorescence directly. So drugs, maybe some heavy metals. Yeah, maybe some processed foods. I just don't know. And we are just getting started in the process and seeing if the human decomposition does lead to some sort of spectral changes in the native vegetation and really over days and weeks.
Well, that's fascinating research, no doubt about it, isn't it?
It is extraordinary. I mean, the body farm, near which you mentioned there, of course, is where you have the opportunity to bury human bodies at different depths and different sort of sites in a bit of woodland and just watch to see the biological process of decay.
Right. I mean, in our initial experiments are all going to be above ground placement. So we can very closely monitor the decomposition stages and exactly what's happening in the biological interactions without having to disturb the body.
Where do you get the bodies from?
You donate them.
Yes. Donors.
Oh, so like you're donating your body to science.
Yes.
And this
yeah.
is what happens
yeah.
to it. Ah, interesting.
Well, we'll watch this space. Neil, thank you very much indeed. And thank you for talking to us today from Tennessee. I think after all of that, it's time for a little bit of music.
Will you meet me on Clare Island? Summer stars are in the sky. We get the ferry out from Runa and wave all our cares goodbye.
The Saw Doctors with a song called Clare Island, the magical and mountainous home of the pirate queen Grainne O'Malley, which guards the entrance to Clew Bay in County Mayo. I've been there many times, and it really is beautiful. I've even seen it from the air when we were filming for Secrets of the Irish Landscape. Anyway, between 1909 and 1911, the Belfast naturalist Robert Lloyd Prager led the exhaustive biological Clare Island survey, which was unprecedented at the time and served as a template for future studies. And now, the new survey of Clare Island, Volume 9, Birds, documents the current bird community on the island and presents up-to-date research on the island's avifauna, including the seabirds, land birds, and water birds. Thomas C. Kelly is editor of the volume and a retired lecturer in zoology at University College Cork. Earlier this week, he spoke with our own Richard Collins.
Well, Clare Island is a large island by Irish standards. It's 1,598 hectares, or approximately 1,000 acres. It's got two peaks, one of which is 1,500 feet, Cnoc Mhór, and the other one, Cnocavine, is 731 feet high. And they're large areas of commonage, green roads. A curious feature of Clare Island is that there are very, very few wetlands. Freshwater wetlands, and those that are there can be described as lochans. But there are huge areas of closely cropped peaty grassland and stupendous cliffs and large numbers of seabirds on those cliffs. And then around the fields and the farmland, you've got lots of wheat ears, lots of meadow pipits, some skylarks. And then in the thickets, you've got willow warblers and recently chaffinches. In the houses, tree sparrows. But recently they have given way to house sparrows again, which is very interesting. Reed buntings and sedge warblers and swallows as well, and plenty of starlings. Chough and the pure variety of rock dove. One of the best places to see the pure variety of rock dove is on Clare Island.
Tom Prager, he was the one who initiated this great survey, this series of surveys now. Where did the idea come from to have such a survey, and why did he choose Clare as the place to do it?
Well, the survey involves everything: geology, geography, archaeology, and building up on that soils, freshwater biology, and then right across the ground to every bit of the biodiversity that you can find. And so I suppose that one of the big issues was finding a place that was manageable in size and that was on the Atlantic. Now, I have to say that this is very well dealt with in the first volume of the 9-volume series, and I wouldn't be absolutely familiar with the exact reasoning behind it. I do know that they started with Lambay and then they moved over to Clare Island.
Doing a survey 100 years ago, you wouldn't have the fancy binoculars and telescopes, and they would have binoculars, but they wouldn't be great. And you wouldn't have the reference books or the experience. Even getting to the place, it's, what, 5 kilometres out or something. You probably had to go on a curragh or something. It is a much more challenging thing to do and a much more problematical thing to do than it is for us to do it now. Are the results comparable as a result?
I think so. I mean, if you look at the bird paper by Usher, they covered virtually the whole year over the 1909-1911 interval. So they did go out in most months and they spent quite a bit of time there, particularly Professor Patton and Prager himself and various others. So I think that the results are comparable insofar as any survey of an island 110 years later is comparable. I think it is comparable, yeah. You have to say, first of all, that what you're comparing with Usher is an inventory. You're not comparing numbers. What we tried to do was to establish a numerical basis for the number of birds on the island of each different land bird species. The seabirds had already been censused. The water birds, the wading birds and the wildfowl are so widely distributed, but in extremely small numbers that it's very difficult to get a definitive number for them. But for the land birds, we attempted a detailed estimate, and the seabirds then, Owen McGrail and his group and NPWS, and in collaboration with Birdwatch Ireland, they have produced very, very detailed numbers, which we did in the initial phase, Bob Cusson and his group, in 1999. But of course, that is not comparable in terms of its depth and accuracy with the Usher paper of 1912. But what is comparable, I think, is the inventory. And for example, they didn't have any of the seabirds. They didn't have any fulmar. They didn't have any gannet. They didn't have any lesser blackback gull. They didn't have any cormorant. They didn't have any common gull. They had Arctic tern, which are now gone. But now we have this array of new species which have arrived in the interim. And the most recent addition is the Banksia great skua, but that has gone. I wouldn't imagine that there's any difficulty in saying that in their survey, the species they listed and found are comparable with the species that we have listed and found. And I think that's reasonable, despite the fact, as you rightly point out, that the technique of ornithology, the instrumentation, etc., has changed dramatically.
How many species on the Clare Island bird list?
It's 128, approximately.
And how many did Richard Usher clock up 110 years ago?
I can't remember. I know that he clocked up 28 land bird species, and nobody has ever equaled that since.
Well, now there are winners and losers since his time. Who are the winners?
Well, I suppose the winners that have arrived recently include the willow warbler, the chaffinch, and the losers would be the corn bunting and the yellowhammer, which have completely disappeared from Clare Island.
Well, the winners, you go back to whenever the gannets arrived, but before them, back in 1915, we had the first fulmars prospecting. And now this is a great fulmar island. The walk from the view, you know, the little tower, the lookout tower, if you walk from that all the way to the lighthouse, you see fulmars all along on the cliffs. Every few metres, at least the last time I was there, which is a few years ago now, there were fulmars everywhere. It was a marvellous fulmar colony, and that is new in a sense since our friend's time.
Absolutely. It's not clear when the fulmar finally bred on the island, but Dr. Claire Lloyd reckons it was probably sometime in the 30s. And I think she's probably right about that. They have declined recently, and two censuses, one in 1999 and one very recently by Owen McGrail's group, show a decline of about one third. This is difficult to understand, but it appears that some colonies have declined and some are doing very well. It's a very difficult thing to explain.
Yes. Now, the other great winner, it seems to me, is the gannet. Now, the fourth Irish gannet colony was established there back in 1978. I remember going to see it. and there were only perhaps a dozen pairs nesting on this stack. Now it's huge, I gather.
At 350 pairs approximately, Owen McGrail did a recent census, and that's the number that are there. And obviously, this is very interesting because at the same time as the colony was growing, the Great Skua arrived and bred on the island for a couple of years. It doesn't do so anymore, apparently, but it did arrive in 2015, 2016, and it didn't breed in 2019, but it is breeding on associated islands, including Cahir, which is just a couple of kilometres from Clare Island.
Yes, I think Cahir was the first one. I remember the year it was first identified. I had visited Cahir and saw great skuas flying around. I didn't think they were breeding. It never dawned on me to look. I said, they can't be breeding. They don't breed here. So the great skua, do you think it will prosper in the West?
Well, it seems to be prospering at the moment. I mean, I'm not privy to all the details, but I've had a good report of them landing on Inishtushkert in the Blasket Islands, which would push it, as it is, they're much further south in Ireland than they are in the UK. It's an extraordinary development. And as far as I know, there's no obvious explanation for why it has happened.
It is a strange one, a big predatory gull, a big hawk-like gull. It is a very impressive, the shite hawk. You don't use the term shite hawk.
That's right.
It's a piratical seabird. You should explain why it's called the shite hawk, perhaps.
Well, I think one of the things that people are worried about is that it attacks other seabirds with tremendous ferocity, and it kills a lot of seabirds, particularly auks and kittiwakes. The feeling is that if it began to colonise in large numbers, it could do the seabird colonies of the west of Ireland a lot of damage. I think particularly perhaps shearwaters and petrels would be very vulnerable to it, but it is an absolutely ferocious predator of other seabirds. And of course, it's also a scavenger, and it'll land on carcasses and feed lustily on those carcasses, and perhaps that's how it attracted that particular name.
Well, I thought it was because the bird dropped its the food it was bringing home to its chicks, and it was thought that the contents of the bowel had been discharged. I thought that was the reason people homed in on this name. But
I haven't heard that. Yeah.
You mentioned how aggressive they are. They're aggressive. They don't suffer fools gladly. I remember being on the island of Hoy in Scotland, and there's a fine colony there. But go near the nests at all, and they will let you know. Yeah. They will hammer you. I wouldn't like to tangle with one of them. They're tough customers. We've talked about the winners. Now, the losers. There are several conspicuous losers. It was said that the Golden Eagle had an unbroken record of a pair occupying the same eyrie for the past century. That's gone, of course. 14th of October, 1887 is a date that I think that the eagle in the Natural History Museum comes from Clare Island, does it?
It does. Unfortunately, it was shot. And obviously, that was the end of that. They're sedentary. They don't spread that much. Once it was shot, that was the end of its occupancy of the island. The white-tailed eagle was subsequently shot there in the 1930s, but it was obviously not well when it arrived, and it was at low altitude, and it was taken. Obviously, the island had sufficient seabirds, and it would appear grouse, up until the 1880s for it to survive, for a pair to survive and rear chicks.
Tom, this is a remarkable achievement, this survey, and your chapter on it is fascinating. It's got all kinds of interesting asides to it. It's quite readable, even to people who have no great specialisation in any of it. I would recommend it highly, and I congratulate you on the great work that you've done.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you all. Bye now.
Thomas Kelly talking to Richard Collins, and more details on our website rte.ie/Mooney. Richard, you were talking there about birds. Obviously, it was volume 9 and it was about the avifauna of the island. But during the week, this gentleman came up to me, totally random, and said to me, did I know anything about Clare Island? I said, well, I've been there, I've filmed there, I've interviewed people there. And he said, do you know if there are any frogs there? He said, I'm from the area. And an islander who's friendly with me told me there were no frogs on the island. I said, actually, I don't know, but maybe you would know, Richard. So, are there frogs on Clare Island?
I don't believe there are any frogs on Clare Island, Derek. I have a couple of reasons for saying that. You should never make a universal and negative statement. You can never say something isn't somewhere unless you really have seen absolutely every nook and cranny. But I do not believe they are there. Now, why do I say that? Well, the Irish Peatland Conservation Council did a hop to it survey. The hop to it survey was a survey of frogs in Ireland. And their map from 2017, I think, shows absence. There's no record on that on the island. In fact, none of the West Islands have. The Aran Islands don't have the map of Ireland, or have presence, I don't think. And anyway, the birds are a clue to this, remember, because you only have the mallard and the moorhen among the ducks. Now, if there were frogs, you might expect to have a greater variety of ducks. Of course, there isn't much open water. There is an area called Avulin, Loch Avulin, I think is the name, but it's kind of overgrown now. But it hasn't got water rails. The avian rat is the water rail. And if there were frogs there, the avian rat, I think, would have thrived. So I would venture to put my not a lot on it, that there are no frogs. Of course, some child might have brought them in last year, frog spawn, and they might release them. That's always possible, but I don't believe there are any frogs on
Well, I'm sure
island.
People listening on the island can confirm. You can email mooney@rte.ie. Do that during the week, Richard. Thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the Botanic Gardens in Glasnevin, to Eanna Lana, to our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and the researcher, John Bella Riley. Until next week, goodbye.
Visit the website rte.ie/Mooney.